Hello, listener, and welcome to Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. I'm David Maguire, creative director at Radix Communications, and here with me, fresh from her storming success presenting our B2B comedy special, is our managing director and lead copywriter, Fiona Campbell-Howes.
Hello.
Hello. Wasn't the comedy episode great?
It was really good, yeah. We had three really good people on there giving lots of tips about how to use comedy and B2B copywriting, things that I'd never thought of or would never have considered, but just really good advice.
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening. It was fabulous for me just to sit back and not do anything and let you and the experts just take it all away.
They were great. So, thanks to Craig and Paulina and Richard again for joining us on the podcast last time. They were brilliant.
Yeah, that was great. In this episode, we'll be talking about which content gets the best results and what tactics B2B marketers are using. And I'll also be talking to Jake Kimpton from Three White Hats about how you use Google Analytics to find out which pieces of content are really engaging with your audience. As ever, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, we really want to hear them. So send an email or a voice memo to podcast@radix-communications.com or tweet us at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. So, Fiona, the big news this month is that this year's CMI Marketing Profs B2B Content Marketing Report is out. It's looking at benchmarks, budgets and trends. Now, sadly, this year there isn't a separate UK version, but the North American one has a lot in it to discuss. For example, I mean, I saw some of the headline stats. 70% of respondents are more successful with their content marketing than they were 12 months ago. 61% are using more digital written content now. Only 6% are using less, although 17% are now using less print. So year on year, the transition from print to digital is moving onwards. And 56% are spending more on their content creation. So perhaps the much heralded demise of content marketing is nowhere to be seen yet, or maybe the figures are self-selecting.
Well, maybe, but no, it does seem like content marketing is something that's now embedded, and the people that are being successful with it seem to want to do more of it, and, you know, are planning to spend more on it and create more content next year. So what I got from it is the people for whom content marketing is working well, and they're going to do more of it. And I think it is interesting because I think content marketing is something that gets better over time. Mm-hmm. It's something that does take quite a long time to get going. You have to have quite a lot of build-up of content behind you before it starts making an impact, I think, on your audience. So it's almost what I'd expect to see is that it's something that does get better over time, and if you get good at it, then you want to do more of it.
So, and what stood out for you in the report?
So quite a few things stood out. From a very selfish point of view, it's nice to see that people are creating more written content and that written formats are still the ones that people seem to think are most effective.
Absolutely.
So I think one of the questions was, you know, which formats are most effective at different stages of the funnel? And it tended to be, you know, blogs at the top of the funnel and white papers in the middle of the funnel and case studies at the end of the funnel. So all of that, well, case study can be a video case study as well, but mostly those are written formats, and so that's nice for us to hear as a copywriting agency.
Yes.
I did find that question interesting for another reason, though, which is something that you'd pointed out to me earlier, which is that, you know, the question was which of these formats are most effective at the different funnel stages, and there was no format that came out as being most effective at the bottom of the funnel. And I find that really interesting because I think this is something we've talked about before on this podcast, which is that the CMI itself, but I think content marketing in general has a bit of a weird relationship with the bottom of the funnel. It doesn't really like that end of the funnel.
Because it feels too much like traditional marketing.
Yeah,
right?
Or it feels like sales. Yeah. Or, you know, it's sort of product-focused stuff at the bottom of the funnel. And I think content marketers feel like they should be creating, like, really sort of interesting sort of storytelling style, quirky style content at the top of the funnel, and maybe sort of really helpful, useful, how-to type content in the middle of the funnel. But they just sort of feel a little bit, oh no, we don't like the bottom of the funnel where we have to talk about product, talk about ourselves. So I don't know if that's fed into that answer or not, but it was interesting.
Absolutely. And only 42% of content marketers use conversations with real customers to inform their content. That's astonishing.
I don't know if it's astonishing. I think, you know, from my general experience, it feels about right. But I think that for that question, it's like, how do you get customer insight? That was the question. Mm. And I think the top answer was that marketers talk to salespeople, so they get feedback from salespeople. So, you know, I think that's okay. You know, it would be nice if marketers were out talking to customers more and getting that kind of, you know, proper kind of face-to-face interaction with them. But if they're talking to sales about, you know, what are customers thinking about, what questions are they asking, what are they worried about, I think that's okay. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that, for me, they're more likely to use social media listening than to actually talk to a customer. And it's not like, I mean, if we're talking about B2B, it's not like kind of consumer stuff where it's vast numbers of faceless people and you don't know who they are and where they are and you've got to do big surveys and things. You know, generally speaking, in B2B, it's a relatively limited number of customers, at least, and a relatively strong relationship. The thought that you just wouldn't talk to somebody, I find... Frank, bizarre. I mean, as you say, chimes with our experience of the market, but it's still, I find it astonishing.
You know, if I think, because the place that marketers are going to come into contact with customers are at events that they've organised. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been to quite a lot of those, and I feel that what happens at those events is that marketing may have organised it, but they kind of hang about in the sort of behind the scenes, and they let the salespeople actually talk to the customers and have the conversations, and that may be part of thinking that it's not their role to be talking to customers in those kind of situations, or it may be a kind of indication of the misalignment of sales and marketing. Maybe marketing doesn't want to tread on sales's toes, or sales don't want marketing there talking to the customers. So I think that's part of it.
Oh, I spent a whole day listening to people talking about this at the B2B ABM conference, about this exact thing,
right?
About the role of marketing and sales alignment, and who sits where, and all of this stuff, and the alignment piece. In terms of coming up with really good like ABM marketing content was just came through so clearly. I mean, there was a great conversation with Adrian Hardy, I think his name is, from BT, who's their global head of ABM, and the way that he sits with their, you know, with their sales team and actually helps them with presentations and to deliver the presentations and stuff. It was really, it's a different way of looking at it. It was very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, that's just, a thought just struck me. There was nothing in this CMI survey about ABM, ABM techniques, personalization. And, you know, I think we've always felt that ABM is almost like the next step in content marketing. You know, you take what you've learned from content marketing and then you personalize it and apply it to individual accounts. And I think we even had that as a trend we were going to watch at one point.
Well, our trends are always 2 years in advance, so it's next
maybe
year.
Maybe it's that. But it didn't seem to, I don't know, it just struck me. It didn't seem to come out there. There was no real mention of kind of personalization or targeting in there with content.
Yeah. And one other thing I found really weird is that 79% of respondents said their organisation values creativity and craft in content creation, and 73% always or frequently prioritise their audience information needs over their own sales or promotional message.
Yeah.
Yeah? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that what you see in the content that's out in the world? Really?
Well, there's two things there. So you've pulled out two things. And I'm not sure that I'm completely in agreement with you about the first one. I mean, 79% say they value creativity and craft in content creation and production. And I think our feeling is that, you know, that can't be true, because all we ever get is like, how much is this going to cost us and how quickly can you do it? Not like, how beautiful is this piece of work writing that you're going to create for us? But I think, you know, valuing creativity, that's It doesn't say prioritise its creativity and craft. So it's almost like, well, they value it when they see it, but that may not be what they set out to get. So I think that's a strangely worded one. 73% always prioritise their audience's informational needs. We do not see that. Obviously, we do with some marketers who, you know, are really thinking about their content and who is the audience and what do they need. But I would say, like 90% of the time, that is not what marketers are thinking about. They're thinking about, we've got a product, or we've got a theme that we need to have some content around. We haven't got some content around this. And just the question is, can you create some content around this? Not, is this something that our audience needs or has asked us for?
Oh, I had an interesting follow-up conversation on Twitter with Anne Handley at Marketing Profs about this. Because I was like, you know, I just went on this big rant on Twitter about, yeah, the main thing this tells me is that people are either deluded or they lie to surveys. And not unreasonably responded. She said the survey reflects those for-profit B2Bs using content marketing for at least a year. The creativity and craft question refers to creation and production, so a broader measure of producing your best and most reputable work. She said that she doesn't think 79% is weird because most marketers have a sincere desire to produce their best work. But then again, you don't get great without a fight.
Quoting some guru, I think.
Some guru in a blog post that, yes, I've no idea who. It does chime with a lot of conversations I've been having lately about, you know, you see a lot of people, particularly in content marketing, saying marketers need to be brave. They need to be braver and bolder and, as you know, stand up for the customer and this kind of thing. And actually, maybe it's not the marketer's fault, is what a lot of people have said. You know, maybe they are being, you know, micromanaged or told what to do. Or, you know, is it the marketer saying, we need to have some content about this? Or has the marketer been told, you must have content about this? And I think that's interesting, whether it's actually the marketer's desire to do this and maybe then them being frustrated.
Yeah, and I just think this really depends on the marketer and their seniority and the type of organisation that they're in. Because, I mean, there are some people that want to do really good sort of creative work and get thwarted, I think, by other stakeholders that, you know, that's too out there for us. We need to be, you know, conservative and cautious. And then there are other marketers who I think, you know, creativity isn't their forte, you know, that are there maybe just to deliver the numbers or put in a process or make things more efficient. And so I just think it absolutely depends on the type of marketer and the organisation they're in as to how brave they either are or are allowed to be.
Another trend is that 75% of respondents in the CMI survey now use technology to get better insight into how their content is performing. But how do you actually do that? I asked Google Analytics expert Jake Kimpton of 3Right Hats how we can find out which content works and what doesn't. I'm joined by Jake Kimpton, who is an analytics consultant, no less, at 3Right Hats. And Jake's joined us because we really, as copywriters, it's useful if we can tell what content is working and what content's not. And I know that's something that marketers often struggle with. And as writers, it's helpful for us if we can prove some kind of ROI. Mm-hmm. So it's just really useful to talk to you as an expert in analytics and analysing what happens digitally. Thank you for joining us.
No, that's fine. I'm really happy to be here, actually. I'm really excited to talk about this subject because it's something we get asked quite a lot. And the help available online is huge, it's broad, and it's not always as helpful as it should be. So I'm really happy to help clarify some things.
Oh, great. I mean, it's something where I know that, you know, obviously we write a B2B content, and I know that sometimes the marketers who we work with, who buy our stuff, find it hard to give us feedback on what works and what doesn't. So, I mean, what are some of the ways that
that we can direct them to find out what works?
I think the best place to start actually is to kind of bust a couple of myths. And they're two big ones. And you'll often find marketers will draw towards these metrics. And those two are bounce rate and average page duration, or average time on page. Typically, people look at these as sort of key performance indicators, as if if content is working or if it isn't working. But the problem is they're averages, and they're averages across your entire site. So they can have quite a damaging effect if you're using those to decide whether or not content is working. I just want to give an example of why bounce rate can sometimes be a bad factor. So say in a month you have 1,000 users visit your site, and then next month you have 5,000. So that's 400% increase in users. Sounds great. At the same time, we're measuring for engaged users. So an engaged user could be someone who browses 10 pages on your website. So you would say, okay, great, they're an engaged user. They seem engaged. In that first period, 600 users we classed as engaged. And then in the next period, 2,000 are engaged. So that's a 233% increase in engaged users. Now, at the same time, the bounce rate might increase by 20%. It might jump from 40 to 60%. From a marketing perspective, they may go, that bounce rate's really bad. What's happened? This isn't working. Whatever you're doing isn't working. But if you don't look at the other statistics around that, like user engagement, which has had an increase from 600 to 2,000, then you're placing your decision-making on a statistic that isn't actually giving you the value you want from it. So we're going to just throw bounce rate out the window forever for this chat.
Wow.
Because we don't like it. When we talk to clients, we try and sort of move away because of the fact that it's an aggregate, it's an average. So it's dangerous. It can be very dangerous.
Okay, so bounce rate is out the window.
Bounce rate is out the window.
I wonder if it will bounce.
It's the same with average time on page as well,
So a way cooler way
to
tell which content your readers like. Okay. Step one.
Yeah, cool. So and we've discussed this before. So the problem with bounce rate is that I could go to an article on your website and I could scroll around, I could read it, I could go up and down, I could sit there for 20 minutes reading it, I could pull over a colleague and tell them about it. I could then close the tab. That's a bounce. Now that's ridiculous, because I've engaged with that content, I've consumed it, I've even told my colleague in the office about it. So how can we class that as a non-interactive hit? And that's the problem with bounce rate, is if unless you click on the page or you go to another page on your website, there is nothing being recorded there. As soon as I leave, if I don't interact, then it's a bounce. So the solution is to add a custom piece of script into the website, which will measure things that Google doesn't measure. So that's things like scrolling up and down the page, using the arrow keys, using the space bar to go from section to section within a website. And the way we do that is we add a monitor that looks for those things like mouse movement, scroll. And for every 5 seconds of time they are not idle, we tell Google that. We say, hey, this person's been, they're active, they're doing something on your page. They're not clicking, but they are scrolling or they're...
So a monitor, sorry, is
it? Kind of like a monitor, a listener, So it's...
Oh, it's like a little program. It's not like a screen.
No, sorry. Monitor is in like a listener.
Or a lizard.
And then for every 15 seconds, it adds an increment into Google and says, this person's been active, regardless of if they clicked on something. They are clearly engaging with your content. So then you get a new metric out of that, and it's a custom metric, which is average engagement. And we also get total engagement time. So between the two, you can then use total to know literally the total time people were on your page, on your article. But we can also then divide that by the page views, and we can get an average time as well. So that is very useful. And I think what I'll do is, there's a really great guide by Simo. He's a bit of a Google Tag Manager, Google Analytics hero. If you've ever Googled anything really technical, I can guarantee he came up number one in Google, Simo Harver. So I think we'll put a link in the blog for that. So
yeah,
you guys can...
In the show notes, for
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. So that's definitely the first step, is just forget bounce rate. Look at something that's more meaningful, because not everyone's going to click on an article,
But that's something that, you know, that presumably as a listener, you know, I can't do myself. No. I need to talk to an analytics consultant.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you. And yeah. Is that a thing that's complicated and expensive to do?
Not necessarily, no. It could be up to half a day's time where we'll sit down with you and we'll get that working on site. But also, actually, we could talk to your, if you've got a development team, if you've got, you know, or you've got an in-house web development team, it may be something that they can actually look at as well. So it's not locked down to just one type of specialty. You know, if you've got a web developer or you've got an agency, then they could probably look at doing that as well.
Cool.
That's really useful. So what have we got next? Oh, yes. This is kind of just an overview one, really, and it's about segmenting your data. So if you've got a blog and it's /blog and then article name in your URL, then make sure you segment that data out. Make sure if you're going to assess the performance of your articles, make sure you only look at the performance of your articles on their own. Don't try and compare it to other types of content on your website. If you've got a home page or an about us page or a contact page, the performance indicates for those pages are going to be totally different to a blog, because you're not going to get, you know, your average time on page and things like that are going to be totally different. A contact page, someone may spend 10 seconds finding an email button or to find a phone number, whereas on a blog you may be spending 5 to 10 minutes. So make sure you segment that out, and that's actually built into Google Analytics. You can either create a custom segment, or another way of doing it is creating a new view and then adding a filter to say only look at blog content with, you know, the URL /blog. So only look at things that include the blog. And then that's one way of, I guess, not tainting your perception of that data. So that's something to be aware of.
So that makes it easier then to work out, you know, say you've got a load of blog posts, then if you've got just the blog posts, it makes it that much easier to work out which ones are working
definitely.
For your audience,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And it says it, you kind of like declutter all the rest of the website, because it, as a B2B, if you're writing, if one of your main goals for your website is to produce content, then actually the peripherals or pages aren't as relevant to you, because what you're trying to deliver is a story. So don't try and compare the performance of other pages to those articles, because they will be different.
So. Okay, so we're talking about segments and views and filters and things. Are these all things that people can pick up themselves fairly easily within Google Analytics? Is there, you know, it's all right there, is it?
Yeah, so both things are default. You know, they're already built into Analytics. So your segments means it allows you to segment data at a view level, so you can split the data in a view. So you could add a segment that only shows traffic to the blog. If you know the URL, again, if it's /blog/a post name, you can add like an asterisk there, so it will just show any blog posts, and then that allows you to compare it against the other website traffic. The other way of doing it is through a view, and that you apply a filter to that view to say only show me in this view article data and traffic. The only downside of that is you cannot compare it against the rest of your traffic, because that view is only showing traffic to your blog.
Okay. I think my head is spinning slightly. is there a place that we can kind of link to in the show notes where there's kind of a glossary on,
yeah, definitely,
on what,
yeah,
a segment is, what a view is,
yeah,
what
absolutely
a filter is?
Yeah, sure. There's the Google Docs themselves are really, really helpful, the documentation. So we'll put some links in to help people build those.
Super,
yeah.
Thank you. But the idea is basically that we take out, you know, that we make sure that we're comparing like with like.
That's right, yeah.
And that we take out anything that clutters that we don't want to see.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, cool. So that's how we find out which content works best for us. Is there a way that we can work out which content is driving, you know, money, is, you know, driving when people get in touch? Can we find out, you know, if someone's read this and this, they then go and, you know, they'll email us or phone us or send us a carrier pigeon or whatever?
Yeah, there's a really, really, really good way of doing that, and that's using page value. So when you set up a goal in analytics. It may be that it's for a contact submission, you know, or someone clicking on a contact us link.
So you define that as a goal?
You define that as a goal. So you could say, you know, when someone clicks an email link, this is a goal. That would probably require a bit of Google Tag Manager implementation to sort of tell Google Analytics that when someone clicks on this link, this equals a goal. And then when you've created that goal, you can then attach a value to that goal. So this is the most difficult section, I suppose, is how do you know what the value is of someone? Say you write an article and it's got a white paper PDF mm-hmm. attached to it, which is pretty standard. Lots of people do that.
So PDF's still a thing?
Yeah, big time, yeah.
I keep hearing that PDFs are dead. People really? Keep asking us for them, and we keep writing them, and then you go to events, people go, ha-ha, PDFs, like they're still a thing. You? As far as I know, they are still a
PDFs,
thing.
PDFs are still pretty useful.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's all right. So the difficult part is how do you know how to assign a value to something, like a goal, where a white paper is downloaded? You could say, actually, somebody downloading that white paper to us is worth £50. So you have to, there's two ways of doing it. You can either pull a number out of thin air and go, yeah, it's probably about £50. Or you can actually look at your sort of your sales pipeline uh-huh. and you can kind of track back from that and go, well, you know, if this client makes X a year, if a new lead equals X and of the new leads we get, 10% come through the website, you can kind of track back and try and pull out a value to what that goal individually means to you. So I'll try and do like a little example. Mm-hmm. So let's take a blog article, and let's say you've got a white paper PDF attached to it. Say we assign that white paper PDF download £50. So that means every time someone clicks on that, within a session, you're going to say, great, that's worth £50 to us. As a company, that's worth £50. So that article receives 5,000 unique page views. Out of that 5,000, 225 of those unique page views, of those users, they downloaded the PDF. So 225 people downloaded that PDF.
Out of 5,000?
Out of the 5,000.
Okay,
yeah.
With you so far.
That's pretty good. I mean, we're pretty happy with that. Okay, so... So if we're saying that each download is worth £50, 225 times 50, it's £11,250 worth of value has happened during that article.
And we probably only charge the client £300 for the web page.
So we have to take that figure, and then we take the total goal value, which is £11,250, and we divide it by the total unique page views, which was 5,000. So that gives us a page value of £2.25, okay? So it sounds pretty low.
Right.
But what that's doing is Google Analytics is saying, well, you know, someone visited this page and they triggered a goal which was worth money. And we're going to say, well, it was only a small percentage of those people out of the total that visited that page that actually performed that action. So we're going to say that that's worth £2.25, that page. So then you can use page value as a very interesting way of ordering sort of content and looking at it in terms of, you know, monetary value. So you may find that some pages are only worth 30p, mm-hmm. some might be worth zero, some might be worth 50 quid.
Right.
It totally depends on how you add value to your goals. And you have to remember that within a session, I might trigger 5 goals. And if each goal has got a monetary value attached to it, then they're all going to attribute back to that page. So, you know, your figures can vary quite a lot. But it's a very good way of looking at it as sort of a helicopter view and just saying, like, you know, these top 10 pages, these have got a very high value compared to the entire rest of the website. Uh-huh. So now we know that this kind of content is worth a lot of money to us.
And that tells you the people who buy stuff from us, or the people that get in touch with us, may end up buying, depends if the sales team is any good. Those people, by and large, have read some of this content.
Yes.
This is the content that drives...
This is driving.
...business.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that would be really helpful if clients could come back to us with a list of that. They don't tell us anything.
Oh, no, difficult.
You know,
difficult.
It's like we do an A-B... You know, we do multiple, you know, email campaigns. We do multiple subject lines so they can A-B test them.
Yeah.
And they'll never tell us what worked the previous time, the last time we A-B tested, so we can't optimise.
I'll make it too easy.
yeah, we just have to guess. I'm sure somebody somewhere is looking at the data, but they're not telling us. So that can kind of give
our clients, that can give copywriting clients a clue as to which bits of content are performing well for them, both in terms of engagement, but also in terms of what's actually driving the business and tying that back to ROI, right?
Yeah, definitely. And that's kind of the end goal, isn't it? You want to know, like, how much money do you spend on creating this content? Because if it's not generating ROI, then what's the point? Uh-huh. That's the end goal. So that kind of sort of connects the two very endpoints there, which is, you know, how much money are you making and how much money are you spending on things to go on the website?
Absolutely.
So that's quite useful.
So I suppose the other side of working out what works is there anything in the data that can give copywriters or the marketers that are briefing them inspiration as to what they need to do next?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I've been thinking about it quite a lot, actually, because it's, you know, how do you do that? You can't just keep going out and asking people all the time, what are you interested in? So that costs a lot of money as well, doing that. So there's a couple of ways we could do it. There's external search. So Google, for instance, you can access your Google Search Console, which will give you data about the queries which you and your website are appearing on Google in. So things like clicks, impressions, and click-through rate, including the terms used to trigger your appearance on Google. So
an impression is a time you have appeared on a screen somewhere in the world where you have been included in the
listings. You've been included in the listings.
You've been seen by a pair of eyes somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and that's really important, because if you're getting really high impression rates, say you get 10,000 impressions for a certain term every month, but you're only getting 20 clicks, that's pretty bad. You need to try and figure that out. So it's good to take that term and actually go and Google it and find out why people maybe aren't clicking on your website. That could be that they are finding more relevant content from other websites. It may just be that the way that your metadata is worded in your title, it's not quite as relevant as somebody else's website.
And that's where, like, you can look at things like your meta description and stuff, right? Because am I right in thinking meta description still doesn't affect ranking? It's basically a pure copywriting job.
Click here. And that's so relevant as well. You know, you need to understand what people are looking for. Mm-hmm. It may be that the search term is just, it's just not quite your post isn't quite about that. Mm-hmm. So maybe write a similar post which kind of targets that. You know, that high ranking in terms of impressions, that high ranking result. So that's one way of doing it. The other one is actually content improvement. So from that same report, you can actually get the average position for landing pages. So you can look at your list of landing pages and it will give you the average position they are in Google. Normally it will say something like 2.4. It's always in decimal. So you can use that again to then decide which ones are lower in the ranking, but as important. So you might have some that are like an average of 19 or 20. So they're on like page 2, page 3. They're pretty far down. What can you do to improve those? And again, take the term that's triggering them, go and Google it, find out what other people are doing. How are other people getting higher up the rankings? Is it, again, because it's not quite relevant? Have you got a post that's semi-relevant but not quite enough to make someone decide to go there, and therefore Google's doing the same thing? It's going, well, they're not quite relevant. They're sort of relevant, but not enough. There's 50 other posts that are far more relevant. So again, try and improve that content. The other way is internal search. And this is a bit of a gold mine, and I don't think people really take notice of this.
No, I've been telling clients to do this for years. This is what I think it is.
Yeah, if you've got a search on your website, Google has built-in systems to track those queries. You just need to enable a couple of settings in your admin settings. It's at a view level. It's called site search tracking. So you literally click a button and enable it. And all you need to provide Google with is the query parameter in your URL. So that's like when you search for something, say I search on your website and I look for B2B podcasts, it will normally have like a question mark and then it would say Q equals and then my query. So it's that Q, that value you need to tell Google. This means it's a search, that someone's looking for something. Once that's all set up, Google will just automatically collect all of that data. And that's really important. And you can look at that in analytics. It's under behavior and site search.
So that will tell you what people have, you know, what people are looking for on the site, but they haven't been able to find through you.
Yeah, potentially. It might be that they found it. It's just they didn't want to look for it. But what's important there is understanding the queries that you're definitely not answering. And again, it's the same with Google Search Console. You're just looking at that list and you're deciding what are we not answering. And you'll find some very strange queries, people search in very strange ways. And it may be that you do have the content there, but their query is not quite matching up with how your site search is working. So it could be that actually you just need to, on a technical level, you just need to improve the functionality of your search engine, or it may just be you need to write content to answer their questions.
Great. There's a ton that we can talk about, but we're already way over time. Thank you so much for coming in, making the effort for coming and talk to our listener. It's very helpful. I think that if people have got any more queries on this, it might be that we can collate people's questions.
Definitely.
On Twitter, or if people want to email podcast@radix-communications.com, if they want to hit us on Twitter @radixcom, that we can put there and we can pass those questions on to you. You know, maybe do a follow up or whatever if that's what people want to do. So if you have any comments, any questions, any queries, any tips and advice, then do feel free to get in touch. Jake, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Jake for his time. It's good to hear that PDFs aren't dead. And I'm particularly interested to think about this stuff that we were saying around the marketers that whose job is they're there to get the numbers. And if having the numbers, like Jake's just told us how we can get, will help them to provide evidence that creativity actually leads to ROI, or maybe having data is a bit of a false journey, really. And actually, they just need to move away from that and understand that you can't measure everything. So with the discussion I was having on Twitter with Anne Handley about the survey, Robert Rose from the CMI joined in the discussion. He said, in our experience, B2Bs are still trying to figure out marketing as distinct from sales enablement more broadly. And to them, content as an approach is new. Actually, taking a creative or an emotional or distinct point of view on anything is a big, scary thing. And we had a few more questions back and forth because there's a few things in that I wasn't quite sure about. But I asked whether the answer to convincing obstructive stakeholders lies in having more data to prove the value of creativity, or if that takes us even deeper into a short-term idea that things only matter if they can easily be measured. Robert says he thinks it's a mix. Data helps, but it's not a cure-all. We have to make business leaders care. That means appealing to emotions. It's like the Homer Simpson quote to his daughter, "Oh, honey, just because I understand doesn't mean I care." We have to find reasons for the C-suite to care. So what do you think, Fiona? I mean, is it data versus emotion when we're trying to get marketers and the stakeholders more involved in creative content? You look doubtful.
Well, I actually do think that if you've got evidence to back up the fact that a very sort of creative and emotionally charged piece of content did actually perform very well for you and led to tangible benefits for the business, I think that is going to help convince the C-suite. So I don't know if data takes you off down the wrong track there. I think that can be really good. I think I'm still a little bit stunned by Robert Rose saying that content is new in B2B and that marketers are trying to figure out marketing as distinct from sales enablement. Because, I think content marketing began in B2B. People are always talking about, the furrow and John Deere back in the day. And it's B2B that's pioneered content marketing. And, it's 2018 now, so we've been doing it for quite a while. Not in every sector of B2B, but certainly in the tech sector where we are, it is a kind of embedded and tested and proven approach now. So I'm not sure that it is something that's entirely new.
Yeah, it might be something where people want to get involved and discuss this a bit more on Twitter or other forms of social media when the podcast comes out. Hashtag good copy, bad copy. And unbelievably, that is all we have time for, I'm afraid. I'll have to leave my nomination for the B2B Content Hall of Fame for another month, but I know you're itching to hear that, but we just had too much to talk about this time. Thanks again to Jake Kimpton from Three White Hats for giving us his advice. We actually talked for much longer than we could include here, so we'll include some more of his tips in the blog post accompanying this podcast. Thanks also to Anne Handley, Lisa Merton-Beats, Rob Rose, and everyone else who shared their thoughts with us on the CMI survey via Twitter. If you have anything to add to the conversation, or if you'd just like to say hello, do get in touch. You can email us at podcast@radix-communications.com or send us a voice memo. Or, of course, you can find us on Twitter at radixcom. Next time, we'll be rounding up the year's best B2B content as voted for by you, so look out for that on social media. Until then, live long and spell check. Bye.
Bye.